Procrastination is a lot of different things because there's lots of different reasons, but it's mainly avoidance. And at the first part, you might think, well, that's obvious. What's distinctive about procrastination is it's actually avoidance of things that we want to do or we think are valuable to us. That's the puzzle, right? So when someone says, Nick, I'm procrastinating from doing my taxes, I hate it, and I explain it, and then somebody else jumps in and says, well, that's dumb, they just don't want to do it. I'd say absolutely right. If you don't want to do it and you don't do it, I don't think there's a puzzle that needs to be explained. However, many people procrastinate on things they value. They do not undertake tasks where they feel an aversion to things that they think are really important to them, even things they like to do, things they care about. And there'll even be a pattern that the more they care about it, the more they feel the pull to procrastinate. That's a puzzle. Why is it that we resist doing the work or undertaking the tasks or doing the activities that would lead to the outcomes that we value the most, that we care about, that we want, that would have material benefits and all kinds of other things, yet we can't get ourselves to move that? Well, there's a fundamental dilemma that people face that I think self-worth theory helps to unpack and unravel, so to speak. So I would argue, or self-worth theory argues, that this dilemma is, if we're going to demonstrate our worth, if we're going to achieve something of significance, and again, this is an important fundamental human need. Most people have a sense, a desire to achieve for themselves and be perceived as accomplished, right? It's a fundamental human need. But to do that means I need to undertake tasks, activities, do things that are challenging. They're hard, right? Because if I do things that are easy, if I go down the street and I play basketball with the local seven-year-olds and I dunk on them all day, I don't get to say, I'm the greatest basketball player ever. That's too easy of a task. That doesn't really demonstrate my athletic ability. So I must take on a hard task to demonstrate that I have high ability, right? If I do easy tasks, that does not demonstrate that I have high ability, that I've achieved. However, as soon as I undertake a hard task, what have I introduced to this equation? I could fail. So the dilemma is I have to navigate these two things. And then if I really care about something, if I fail in an area that I really care about, then the attribution, the implication to myself is greater, right? Because this is the thing I really care about. It's not like I got up on the karaoke and I sounded awful. Well, so I'm not attached to that. Or I made a terrible mess of that spaghetti that I made. I'm not a chef, whatever, I don't care. But when my identity is wrapped up in it, then what's on the line is not only my performance, but myself, my self-concept and how other people perceive me. We're monitoring often our status relative to other people, particularly with respect to our abilities and our achievements. And this is a signal, this is a sign that these are very important things to human beings. And on the one hand, they can be a positive motivator toward achievement, towards goal, but they can also lead us to, as I said before, to protect, to defend that. And one of the ways that we defend that is we actually don't put in effort. So effort is double-edged. So if I want to protect myself as able and capable, smart, intelligent, a great programmer, and I'm up against a task that's going to test my ability, or I have doubts that I can do it, one way to prevent the attribution to my ability is actually to not work hard, or to not to be systematic, or not to do my best effort, because then I have an excuse. So the argument in procrastination for self-worth theory is we're often creating conditions that prevent a clear, authentic, accurate assessment of our ability, so that if we fail, we have an explanation. That's not about ability. Now, I often feel guilty. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. I should have put more time in. I shouldn't have procrastinated. We feel guilty, but in our society, guilt is more tolerable. Because if I try, if I put all my effort in, if I do everything I can, if I'm the Hermione Granger at my workplace and I do everything and then I fail, I don't have an excuse. I don't have an explanation except that I am not able. And that evokes shame. And shame is a more powerfully aversive feeling even than guilt. They both feel bad, but shame for most people is actually worse. It's rare that a state of fear, worry, doubt, anxiety ever is a is either, number one, is actually is enjoyable. And ultimately, over long term, we cannot sustain that. Our physiology just cannot sustain that. And therefore, our cognition can't sustain that. And in fact, I think if you look at people who achieve over a long period, they may have some sense of anxiety or stress. You know, Michael Jordan hated to lose. But if you look at him when he's on the field, and actually, if you watch that documentary, someone says, you know, what his greatest gift was to be fully immersed in the moment, fully engaged, absorbed. On the court, he's not feeling hatred. He's immersed in his craft and trying to maximize that. And so I do think that especially shame and then fear of shame, that anxiety, they can motivate us in the sense that they give us energy and they can distill a desire. But that fear is not a condition, is not a mental state to then do our best work, right? So I'll say to my students, you know, fear of and calculus don't go very well together, right? Like, it's hard. Fear, physics is hard. So you need to be optimally focused on the physics, not how do I look. And if you're in a state of fear, then you're just not operating cognitively as well as you could. We see this anecdotally. There are people who work with people around motivation and various interactions. So they'll say, okay, go out and experience rejection as much rejection as possible. And then we desensitize, right? If we have it enough, after a while, we just get used to it. Use the word anything. People can get used to anything. So if you have enough rejection, after a while, you can lose the significance of that. Get accustomed to just the experience of failure. And then that reduces the power of the fear. I think there's some truth to that. I think there's other ways to do it. So I'm going to talk about three big ways. So one is simply physiological. The outcome of fear, physiological, is the root of the problem cognitively. It actually is not a bad state to be in if you're playing basketball or football, because you need to exert a lot of energy, but it's not particularly cognitively demanding, right? So that's okay. But if you're trying to do something that's cognitively demanding, intellectually challenging, a state of fear simply isn't useful. However, we can actually manage the physiology of fear, and people have developed that. So there's mindfulness practices, breathing. So just one thing is even to know, oh, wow, I'm feeling some anxiety. I have some dread in my gut. If I can stop, you know, if I'm looking at my computer, it's not like I'm looking at a lion, you know, then you gotta run. But if it's the fear is the empty page or how it's going to be evaluated, I can just stop. Right? I can take a few minutes, breathe. And so I can work at a purely physiological level. I'm going to ratchet down my physiological response and bring it to neutral. So here's one thing I would say. A lot of people, they fear this thing and they go, I'm going to flip that switch 180 degrees from fear to joy. I think you got to go through neutral first, right? If you're at -1 and you want to get to 1 on the number line, you got to go through 0. So I tell people, focus first on just calm. Get to 0. When we're in a state of fear, we tend to think certain things. We frame things. We look. Our attention goes. We get very narrow, and we think about the problems. And we evoke, oh, this is bad. Thing's going to happen. So this is happening in a cognitive realm, right? And it feeds. So we fearful, and then we think things that evoke fear, and we narrow our focus. We're not thinking, what are all the possible ways to solve this problem? We're thinking, what's going to happen if I don't solve this problem? And so those are at odds. So again, there are certain kinds of tools that we can use to intervene at the cognitive level, self-talk, reframing. And again, there's a lot of, so those are new technologies, if you will, or tools of the 20th and 21st century. So cognitive behavioral therapy or cognitive behavioral training, journaling, explicating, there's lots of things. And then there's another dimension, which is the emotional. It's kind of in between them. So I think of it as kind of like a triangle. The top is the physiology. Then there's the affect or emotional. Then there's the cognitive. And they're interactive. And so the third dimension is emotional self-regulation. So again, mindfulness. There's a lot of practices that help us learn to minimize our reactivity. One of which is simply the understanding of how emotion works. We feel emotion typically very powerfully at first. So if we were to map it as a wave, it'd be like a big jump. And then it slowly comes down. And actually emotions don't last very long. I would say that there's a number of ways that we can intervene and deal with fear and fear of failure. And those are some, there's even more, but I'll stop there. This idea that you should just sort of know your passion. And then you, once you look at it, you find it within like 6 or 7 minutes or less, and then you do it. And I think it's this conception that's mistaken. And then it leads people, number one, to think, I'm supposed to have my purpose and mission. I did not have it until my mid-30s. I was gallivanting around. I mean, that was okay. But when I got it, and then so I had to be thoughtful about it, reflective about it. So I think number one, a big idea too, is just that the process doesn't work like that necessarily. Another point is, in some ways, if I get somebody who's maybe not reflective and they say, I've always wanted to be a doctor since I was 5 years old, I'll say, what other decisions did you make when you were 5 years old that you are sticking to? What other life decisions at five are you bound with? And they're like, I hadn't really thought of it that way. And that's not, I don't like to be confrontational. That's not usually what I do, but on occasion I'll do that. It's kind of pop people's, and that doesn't mean they can't answer it again. So one thing I see is sometimes people are fearful of considering something else because they think the answer is going to be, I don't want to be a doctor or whatever. But actually it's much more important and actually much more common that people, when they truly ask the question, they say yes again with more verve and more power and more purpose than they ever did. Because how much purpose can you have as a five-year-old? And I think it's complicated. I have a lot of empathy for young people in particular right now. It's with so much volatility and change. Our society dumps on young people a lot. And they're living in a world they did not create. They did not create social media. We did. People my age created social media, and we made all the money off of it. And then we say, you guys, you're influenced by social media and technology. What's wrong with you? Like, well, we did it. What are you talking about? There's lots of kinds of motivation. So motivation, in one level, is a set of reasons. We can understand motivation in a cognitive dimension, the reasons why we do things. And the word reason suggests rational cognition, at least, in the realm of thought. We have drives, too. These are physiological. We have a drive to be secure. We have a drive to be safe. We have a drive to avoid fear, or fearful events. Those are aversions. And then motivations are emotional. Like, we have beliefs and values, inspirations, and inspiration is often sort of a thought feeling, right? So for me, motivation is all these dimensions. And sometimes we can even offload motivation. It can be social, right? We're part of a team. I think we never work as hard as when we're part of a team. Individually, it's harder to get work out, for instance, down in the gym if you're by yourself than with someone else, or you run faster or harder. So there's all these different dimensions from my point of view of motivation. There are a few organizing principles that might bring some order to that, and I'm happy to share those. But for me, motivation is multidimensional, and it has all these different components, and that's both a challenge in trying to sort that out, because sometimes the motivations are in opposing directions, right? They're countervailing. But also, to put an optimistic spin on it, that also means there's lots of opportunities to intervene motivationally, right? If there's all these different things, I can think about which ones work well for me, or, that didn't work, let me try another thing in the cognitive realm, or let me try an affective dimension. Human beings are powerfully driven to find and pursue meaning in their lives. So meaning means a lot of things, but significance, purpose. A lot of times meaning is certainly personal. It's about my own growth, my relations to others, but it's often social. So a lot of people's drives and meanings actually often come back to a social impact. They want to make some change in the world, benefit some others, bring some value. And that suggests the value out there is often connected to values in us. So looking inward and then mapping that outwardly into the world and seeing where is some resonance, what's the connection. There's some other things to consider in terms of finding our mission and purpose. It seems to me it's possible, I think, to work in a realm where you don't feel like you're succeeding, and they say, okay, I really want to do that. I'm motivated, I have this value, I want to be a musician, and I'm a musician, music brings joy to people, and I want to do that. But I'm not musical. So I could do that, but I would probably be frustrated at some point. So I do think that some capacity and skill, we do know that for a sense of well-being and positive regard and how we feel about ourselves, which is crucial to motivation, we need to feel good. We need to have a sense of achievement. That is human. And no, I don't think anybody should apologize for that. We want to achieve. That's part of being a human being too. So I think some combination, right, where we have meaning and purpose that's connected to our values, some impact on the social world, some sense that we can be effective, achieve in that realm, I think are important. I think it's a kind of coherence, like that what I do reflects what I care about. And they're not perfect. That's not the world we live in, not perfectly aligned, but there's enough overlap or enough alignment that I can feel good about that. But what are your genuine motivations? And let's dig as deeply as possible. And let's find the most powerful ones and then attach this activity to those powerful motivations that you have. So another way to say that is, what is your motivational profile? I'm going to help you articulate that, surface it, articulate it, write it out. And then what I can do is then we talk about what are methods and techniques to bring those motivations into your mind and body when you need them, right? How do you do that? What are the techniques? When do you need them? When's the point when you feel low motivation? When do you not need them? Okay, well, let's be creative. How could you do this by certain messages? So how do you use your phone actually to remind you of your motivations instead of to remind you of your tasks? How could you interact socially? Can you create a social network that supports your motivation? Are there routines and rituals that you could bring in that are focused on motivation and your motivation? So, and then, you know, then there's other layers. Then we might shift to, okay, what are the obstacles to your, right? Because there's one thing to talk about all the positives and align those. And then we might want to say, well, what gets in the way? What are the obstacles? Are there particular ways of thinking? So this is something I do a lot with people is I listen very carefully and I'll notice that they talk, and you've probably heard this, they talk in a certain way when they're reporting out their self-talk. They actually shift tones. And then they say something like, and then I said to myself, blah, blah, blah. And they actually talk a little bit different. And I listen. And if I hear people say the same phrase multiple times, I'll say, hey, that sounds kind of weird, but do you actually hear yourself saying that? Are you talking to you, saying yourself that phrase? And they'll say, oh, yeah. I said, well, what is that? What's the effect of that talk? And then we work on that. So this is, then we're digging in. Okay, well, is that a true statement? Yeah, it's mostly true. Okay, so it's a true statement. What's another true statement that would actually help you move forward and tap into your motivation? It's also true, I'm not pretending, but that we could replace that other statement. So that statement is true, but it prevents you or poses an obstacle to attaining your goal. It kind of leads you to, oh, I could do it later. That's a common one. I could do it later. True, but not helpful. So let's find another one. Oh, a simple, obvious one is, I could do it later. But if I do it now, I'll have more free time later. All human beings are motivated powerfully, primarily, ultimately, by a desire, a need to feel able and capable. And in the context of work, that might be skilled. I'm a good documentarian. I'm a great basketball player in school. That could be I'm a brilliant mathematician. I've always been told I'm the great writer. I think like a real scientist, whatever that would be. And so this idea is that our self-concept and how we're perceived by others motivates our actions to a great deal. And so self-worth theory doesn't replace, but it adds to other frameworks of motivation. So another big idea in psychology is approach versus avoidance motivations, right? So incentives, rewards, they pull us, they propel us towards something, but punishments repel us, they push us away from things, right? And so that's operating too. And then another dimension of motivation that I work from that contributes or is work thought of through self-worth theory is intrinsic motivations versus extrinsic motivations. So extrinsic motivations often include this piece where somebody's appraising us or judging us, looking at not only our performance, but then the attribution to our ability. So you can see that anything that's extrinsic and is evaluated by others can easily evoke in us feelings, thoughts of being judged. And then the natural reaction is to try to protect against that, to defend against that. So at the one level, it's what are your powerful motivations, but what are the self-talk? What are the habits? What's in your environment? Do you, every time you open up your computer, does a thought pop into your head? I wonder if I have an email. That's a lot of people do that. I do that. And that can easily take us away from why we open up our laptop to begin with, and then get us down a rabbit hole of links and reading and busy work instead of, right, I was going to write my business proposal. And every time I do it, I open up my computer and I'm drawn away. So, but may not be, maybe it's something else.